Welcome to the Hamiltonian Podcast, where we seek to explore various perspectives from top experts, journalists, practitioners, politicians, and academics on the top foreign policy issues facing America today. I'm Gabe Scheinman, the Executive Director of the Alexander Hamilton Society.
As part of our book series on the American role in the world, this book is actually a little bit different because it's a lot about the world's involvement in America and how things that come from abroad can kind of shoot through the system and have a huge impact, obviously, on not only U.S. foreign policy, but on U.S. business and on the relationship between U.S. business and the U.S. government. And so very pleased to have with us Liz Hoffman, who's the business and finance editor for Semaphore and previously was a senior reporter at the Wall Street Journal, where she covered financial markets, corporate deal making, and Wall Street for many, many years. And she is the author of Crash Landing, the inside story of how the world's biggest companies survived the economy on the brink, which is a fascinating book on looking at the arrival of COVID, the American governmental and business response to COVID through the eyes or through the lenses of the CEOs of some of America's largest corporations. And so I'm looking forward to a great discussion on how did business see some of these issues first, how do they interact with government, and where that leads us today. So Liz, congratulations on the book and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Gabe. Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
So let me start with, how do you actually sit down and start a book like this? Because for most of us who remember the impact of COVID way back in March 2020, it was all encompassing. And so one of the hardest things about how to start a writing project when something is so all encompassing is, what is the frame and how do you start? And you clearly chose that you wanted to tell the story about how did American CEOs look at this? And so how do you start with this? How did you go about doing this? And in your mind, how does your book actually structure for the audience?
So, you know, every reporting, every process for me starts with reporting. I'm at heart a reporter. And, you know, the book actually sort of logistically came out of this story that I'd done for the Wall Street Journal that published the first Saturday of April. And it was like 9,000 words. And it was a day-by-day account of March, you know, the month that the economy shut down. Never seen anything like it. And, you know, it had, I think, something like two dozen CEOs, investors, policymakers, day by day trying to get a handle on this thing that was sort of mushrooming by the hour, if you remember. And so it really started in those early days and these conversations that I had. And, you know, that story comes out and it was just so clear to me that there was a massively compelling, quickly changing, unfolding, fundamentally human drama here. And those are the kinds of stories that I like to tell. I'm a sort of a narrative storyteller at heart.
And what do you feel the narrative that you tell, again, through the eyes or through the lenses of these CEOs of major American corporations, in the process of your reporting, do you feel that that is a different story than what was out there before? I mean, did you go into it with a certain understanding, given that everybody obviously kind of lived through COVID, but that you lived through it in a certain way and that showed you a different thing? Or you had an inkling that these guys and gals, mostly guys actually, was going to actually tell the story a little bit differently?
One thing, you know, the reporting is such a constant process. I think the earliest reporting in this book, I'm sure that I did it in March of 2020, and the latest was probably last summer. But, you know, the challenge when I was writing this was I really wanted to bring people back because, you know, the early pandemic was scary and weird and strangely earnest and just kind of bizarre. And, it, you know, became this really fraught, terrible, toxic thing that kind of never ended and this cloud that hung over everything for years. But those early days, I kind of wanted to recreate that emotional stew a little bit and let people kind of sit in it and remember that, like, we fist bumped for a minute and it was funny and, you know, companies were pulling their credit lines and it was huge news. I mean, it just weird stuff was going on. And I think if you're going to try to recreate and go back inside the decisions that were made, the first thing that I had to do was to actually set the stage and remind people just what the stakes were and how in the dark everybody was. And, you know, maybe jumping ahead, one of the takeaways for me was these guys, and you're right, they're mostly guys, were basically as blindsided as the rest of us, which I found just sort of deeply unsettling the more I kind of dug into just how little these people who are, you know, pulling the strings on the world, the biggest economy in the world, just bumping along in the dark like the rest of us.
Was that surprising to you? I mean, I sort of both at the business level and to a certain degree at the U.S. government level, although if you spend enough time in Washington, D.C., you develop a healthy distrust for trusting, obviously, in U.S. government. But the assumption is you run a business, most of the businesses that you, the CEOs that you actually covered run global businesses, whether that's banks, investment firms, or car manufacturers or the airlines, for example. They spend a lot of time and a lot of money thinking about risk and developing hedging or insurance in various ways to think about these things. They have deep relationships in China in a variety of different ways. Were you surprised that, to your point, they felt bumping along in the night just like the average citizen?
Deeply. I mean, I opened the book at Davos 2020, which will go down to me as just like the most absurd gathering of human beings on the planet ever. I mean, and in fairness, I was there, right? I was sort of, you know, three deep, you know, waiting in line for the after parties and swiping cheese off of these communal plates. I mean, these things that in the weeks that would come, this was late January of 2020, would just come to be alien and foreign and seemed just so strange and unsettling. But, you know, I opened there with this private dinner of all the bunch of CEOs and Steven Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, and Wilbur Ross, Commerce Secretary, and all these global CEOs. And to his credit, you know, they're all yakking about ESG and climate change. I think this was the year that Greta Thunberg was there. And that was really the sort of overarching theme of Davos, was this sort of kind of tin-eared corporate babble. And Steven Mnuchin, just credit, stands up and says, you guys, like, you are focused on the wrong thing. There is a city of 11 million people in China that's on lockdown. And, you know, I think when I looked back, especially given how quickly everything unfolded, I mean, that gathering of people who, to your point, should have lines of sight all over the world. They run these global businesses. They are in touch daily with regulators and policymakers, and they just didn't see it coming.
So why is that? I mean, let's start on the business leaders for a second. Then I do want to turn to the government leaders, because there is a little bit of a two-way street here as opposed to who's leading whom. And that's part of what's in the book, which is lots of examples of these leaders trying to get, you know, U.S. government leaders on the phone to say, you need to be doing this, or you have to be doing this, or whatever. And also vice versa, which is the U.S. government trying to tell American businesses how to act. But let's start with the business leaders. So why do you think they were unprepared for this? Or why do you think this wasn't in their briefing report, or in their, even as a black swan event, as you talk about in the book, that wasn't even on the radar for happening?
Yeah, I mean, there's three characteristics of black swan events. One is that they are rare. Pandemics are genuinely rare. You have to go back 100 years to find the last one. You'd have to go back another 300, really, to find the one before that. They are extreme. And the third, crucially, is that when they've passed, there is a tendency to retroactively rationalize them, right? So think about 2008. On the back end of that, of course, housing prices could go down everywhere all at once. Right. It wasn't a thing that happened, but it intuitively makes sense the second you think about it. And this checks all of those boxes. I mean, it's been a long time. This is not something that anyone has lived through. It's not something that I suspect was a module at HBS when these guys were coming up and getting their MBAs. And, you know, the idea that it would, frankly, become more than a China problem. I think there's probably a little bit of global perspective and some sort of biases baked into that, which is like, you know, stuff happens in China from time to time, right? We've had, you know, the various flu varieties that have come out of it. And,
right.
And there's
tendency SARS, to, right?
Yeah, yeah, SARS, H1N1, swine flu, bird flu, and they never turn into anything. Similar with, you know, Ebola in Africa a couple of years ago. These things have stayed contained, and there was nothing in the recent historical record to suggest that this wouldn't. And, you know, obviously now you can look back at 1918, which, you know, looks like this to a T, but there's this sense, I think, at least in the sort of economic and business leaders that I talked to, that, you know, the world just doesn't look anything like it did in 1918, right? I mean, the economy is just so thoroughly modern. There's this sense of sort of destiny or unstoppability to it that I think was really reinforced in the 2010s. I mean, like, you know, the economy just shrugged off every possible, you know, stumbling block and just continued to go up. And, you know, I think given the Alexander Hamilton Society sort of look at foreign policy, I think there's a way to look at this where, you know, there's just this sense going back to the 90s that there was a sort of constant march towards this liberal borderless economy, right? That everything was the sort of end of history that you'll remember, you know, from the early days of kind of NAFTA and the Eurozone and pre-2008 days. And I think that was just sort of the intellectual bedrock of the whole thing, that like we're just on like a glide path forever. And there's honestly, there's just like a lot of optimism is sort of the default of most corporate CEOs. They are business builders at heart.
Did you find, I'm curious, I mean, you did, I think, over 100 interviews for your research for the book, and the book really follows 8 or 9, I think, kind of CEOs in greater depth. Did you find any differences between, let's say, types of businesses? I mean, did you feel that the banks versus investment firms versus, like I said, in the book, airlines, hotels, car manufacturers, that the nature of their business led them to either be better or worse prepared for understanding what was happening and then better or worse prepared for responding to it?
I'll give you kind of two or three sort of counterfactuals. Like airlines, huge part of that story. You know, when I was setting out in the early days of the reporting, it was kind of, you know, I spent a couple of months really developing my kind of cinematic universe, right? What kinds of stories do I want to tell? Because, you know, most reporters have a beat and something big happens on that beat and they cover the hell out of it and then they write a book about it. And this was a little different. This was very forward-looking. And, you know, I chose these, as you note, 8 or 9 stories, but I could have chosen 8 or 9 other ones. But I knew I wanted, you know, airlines was such a huge part of that story. And, you know, I think the first time we meet an airline CEO in the book, it's Ed Bastian from Delta. And it's in January of 2020, and he's at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, which you might rightly note is a weird place for an airline executive to be giving a keynote. This is a gadget show, right? Consumer gadgets and marketing. And, you know, he's giving this talk and he's talking about, you know, Delta is investing in these sort of biometric scans. So it'll read your eye and give you your itinerary. Or, you know, he's talking about the Seatback Entertainment as a streaming platform to rival Netflix. I mean, these are all by way of saying that airlines is at its core an incredibly capital intensive boom and bust business. From one direction or another, every 10 or 15 years, one of these things goes bankrupt. That's just the name of the game. And I think, you know, that's an industry that really should have seen this coming. And not only didn't they, you know, as early as, you know, the first week of March, they're telling the government we're fine, but I think actually had just been sort of lulled into this complacency and had forgotten, you know, the wave of bankruptcies in the 2000s coming on the back of 9/11. And, you know, to Ed's point, was talking about itself like it was not an airline at all. I mean, to kind of escape the gravitational realities of that business. So that's one where you would think that past would have informed present more than it did. You asked about the banks. And, you know, part of the reason that I thought I was perhaps in a position to do this project in the first place is that I had covered banks for a long time. And in the early days of the pandemic, I had really expected this to be a financial story. I mean, if you remember, right, the market peaked mid-February, started kind of freaking out a little bit late that month, and then just, I mean, massively fell off of the cliff. And not just equity prices went down, but you couldn't trade treasuries in size. Money market funds were seizing up and having to be recapitalized. I mean, it was really a pretty precarious moment for the financial system. And I suspected that that would continue to be the story. It turned out that it was actually much more a story of the real economy. But the reason I bring it up is that I think banks did a great job. As it turns out, say what you want about Dodd-Frank and the regulatory legacy coming out of 2008, but they were incredibly well capitalized, did a pretty good job, I think, at a corporate level, you know, at a small business level, getting money at a markets functioning level, getting money where it needed to go. So, you know, those are two industries that I think their past might have suggested a different outcome here, and we got what we got.
But do you think, I mean, you hit on it, to use that bifurcation, do you think that is largely because of the reaction or the pendulum swing the other way to the 2008 financial crisis and legislative changes and regulatory changes that basically forced banks to have larger balance sheet and greater reserves in order to do these things? Or do you think it is a function of the actual government response here in the United States during COVID that started, let's say, in late March, which was first and foremost focused on making sure that what happened in 2008 doesn't happen and getting all this money into the system as quickly as possible, which at some point is going to have a variable impact, let's say, on brick and mortar companies, but should at least keep the financial system liquid?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'll give you a little anecdote, which is at some point, fairly late in the process, I think maybe even late 2021, I think the subtitle of the book was something like Failure and Fortune in the Pandemic Economy. And at some point, I was talking to my publisher at Crown and said, you know, Paul, like, not a lot of failures, it turns out. And to your point, you know, $6 trillion dumped into the economy will backstop a lot of different things. And I think, you know, I'm always hesitant to kind of Monday morning quarterback, but I think the government did a pretty good job here. And there's always a trade-off, and we can talk about it more as some of the cement is starting to harden around the legacy of that. But there's always a trade-off between getting money out the door quickly and getting it exactly where it needs to go. But, you know, the federal government here, Treasury and the Fed, did in about 6 or 8 weeks what it took them 6 or 8 months to do in 2008, what they never did in 1929, 1979, 1987, right? Pick your last crash. And I think deserve a lot of credit here. I mean, that playbook was sort of pulled off the shelf very quickly, modernized, adapted, expanded. I think it should go right back on the shelf and we will need it again one way or the other.
So for most Americans, I think COVID really kind of hit home for them that first or second week of March, where it was really reacting to, at the end of the day, government reacting, let's say, to government decisions. Schools started closing down a little preemptively. Everybody thought it was, you know, 2 weeks to stop the spread or flatten the curve or the various slogans that were used. And you start off, the book starts off with this dinner at Davos at the end of January about seemingly that a bunch of these global business leaders were aloof or this wasn't a priority, not even a point of discussion. The 6 weeks in between, at what point in your mind do you feel like these CEOs reached the, like, oh my God, you know, oh crap moments? Because you have a lot of different anecdotes about, I mean, this anecdote you start the book also about with Bill Ackman giving a talk in London and sort of half reacting to, you know, somebody coughing, anecdote, I forget which CEO it is, a little bit later, of not wanting to shake hands, but still getting on a plane. I mean, these all kind of half personal measures. But at what point did you feel like some of these companies understood what was coming, even if it was belated, to your point? And do you think that they were faster than or slower than the political leaders?
It's a good question. On balance, I think they were faster just because they are closer to the economy on a day-to-day basis. Yeah, I think perhaps without actually intending to, I think I sort of, there's a couple of different moments here, right? Yes, to your point, Bill Ackman in mid-February, bit of a hypochondriac, and I think was sort of emotionally primed to be fairly reactive. You know, there's another story about the CEO of Hilton, who actually, to your point about kind of archetypes of leaders, you know, started his career picking through the SNL rubble in the early 90s when he's in real estate, you know, had just become a public company CEO at Host Marriott when the dot-com bubble burst and had just taken over Hilton in 2008 when they did the big LBO with Blackstone, barely survived that. So this is someone who has, you know, his kind of career has been defined by crises. He's always felt like he's been a step behind and he's trying to stay a step ahead of this one. You know, early March, they have, you know, a series of board meetings, and every time they do, their projections are just immediately obsolete, right? Down 5%, 10%, 15%, 30% bookings, falling off a cliff. And he calls the general counsel and says, do I need board approval to pull my lines of credit, my revolvers at the banks? And the GC says, I don't know, like, we've never done it, right? These are loans that are designed never to be pulled. They're kind of there, and no one ever touches them. And he says, you know what, do it. Like, if I have to pay it back with some interest, fine, but I want every dollar that I'm contractually entitled to. And this was, I believe, March 6th, March 7th. And at the time, I mean, now it just seems like obviously the correct thing to do, kind of a no-brainer. But at the time, it was a news story because Hilton was the first, you know, blue chip company to pull its lines of credit. They were, you know, they took a little bit of heat, I think, for kind of inciting a panic. Remember, there were a couple of storylines floating around at the time about big private equity firms telling all their portfolio companies to pull all their bank loans, very similar actually to the narrative that, you know, set earlier this spring around the bank runs, right, at Silicon Valley Bank. Yeah. Psychology was very similar. But, you know, Hilton got $2 billion, cost them, you know, low millions in interest in the end, and like is obviously the reason that they're still here because, you know, they're operating, their cash flow basically went negative for a while. So, you know, I think there were things like that that are just sort of in retrospect feel like very basic management blocking and tackling, but at the time were incredibly fraught decisions and I think, you know, deserve some credit.
Again, I want to hark on the way you tell the narrative is not actually through the lens of the company, so the lens of the CEO in particular. And so the example you just gave, you know, to me, it sounds like that's through the lens of the company, i.e. it's bottom up. There are things happening on the ground. Stuff has started to change. Bookings are starting to decline. That's a signal. Should we do something about this? You know, versus other examples where, you know, if you didn't know any better, you wouldn't have noticed a change, let's say in business. And this, it's the CEO at the top that is saying, either for whatever idiosyncratic reason, or because, you know, there's issues at their school, or they happen to have been at a place where there was a case, or whatever it is actually making decisions driving the company. So I'm curious, and I know it's hard to generalize, and maybe a better way is example of one example or another, but do you have examples where it is the idiosyncratic nature of the leader that is actually driving the response preemptively, let's say, before facts on the ground are coming up, versus there are certain, to your point, it could be some of the hotel or travel industry companies where they're starting to see actual impact on the ground, even if the leader is not yet ready to be prepared for it?
Yeah, I'd point to two. We talked briefly about Bill Ackman, but he's giving this talk at the London School of Economics in mid-February. And, you know, he's asked about the coronavirus, sort of an open-ended question. And yeah, you're right. There's sort of a comical moment where this kid in the front row kind of sneak coughs and Bill, you know, leans back, like, you know, kind of goes like this and then sort of laughs, but like actually not really. And look, he came home. He'd already been, I think, you know, nervous for a couple of weeks. Like I said, he's a bit of a germaphobe, but he came back and said, man, the world is massively mispricing this. And he does what a good investor does, which is he looks at the market and says, where's the dislocation the steepest? And it was in credit spreads, which is actually not really his game. He's done it in the past, but he's really a value equity investor, stock investor. And he notices that credit spreads are incredibly tight, which is to say that investors and creditors are not assigning more risk to a low-rated company than a high-rated company or a high-rated company than treasuries. And he shorts the credit market. And that, I mean, was a very clear line from what was happening in his head, getting very nervous, thinking people are not paying enough attention to this. And, you know, every investment kind of has three inputs. One is the thesis. So COVID is worse than people expect it to be. The other is the expression, right? Where's the right place to do it? He thought it was the credit markets. And three is the timing. And he nailed all three of those and turned $27 million in swap premiums into $2 billion within the matter of a couple of weeks, just by being a little early. You know, within a few weeks, everyone was as scared as he was. And he's holding one of the most valuable pieces of paper that I have ever seen in the financial markets. The other is James Gorman, who was the CEO of Morgan Stanley. And he takes a trip. to your point where there were places where the CEOs were not quite just like the rest of us. He takes a trip to the Middle East, first couple of days of March. Doesn't really think about canceling, which sort of should tell you kind of where we were, but he goes first through Kuwait and meets with the Kuwaiti Sovereign Wealth Fund, and he gets a temperature check at the gate, which, you know, I sort of encourage everyone to kind of remember, when was the first time that like someone fist bumped you instead of shaking your hand, or someone put a thermometer to your head, or someone right. put down a laminated card in front of you and says, have you been to any of these places in the last 2 weeks, right? Do you have any of these symptoms? It was really unsettling to him. And, you know, the Middle East had gone through MERS a couple of years back, which turns out actually not that similar to COVID, much less transmissible and much deadlier.
But at the time, no one, everybody, to your point earlier about, this is just another one of those things. And
one of those things. And he walks out and says to his head of Europe, who's traveling with him, this could be the big one, right? This is something that, you know, he's a pretty well-read guy. He thinks about this stuff. And, you know, it's been percolating for years that actually the virus that we should all be worried about is not like an outbreak kind of tropical fever thing. It's a low-level respiratory illness that is just dangerous enough to kill a lot of people, but not so dangerous that people like board up their windows, right? There lives in this kind of this sweet spot that scares the hell out of everyone and scared the hell out of him. But I will also note that he, 2 weeks after that, caught COVID by doing the kind of thing that, you know, even at the time, but certainly within a couple of weeks, felt a little silly. I don't know about you, but, you know, there was a time when we were either still out or starting to venture back out. You did this kind of grim calculus in your head, like, if I get COVID doing this thing, is this worth it? Is this going to be a dumb story, right? You're kind of doing this kind of grim trade-off. And he got it, we think anyway, at the, he's Australian. He was getting an Australian chivalric honor at the consulate, and something like 12 of the 18 people there. This was March 15th, I think, a time that, I don't know about you, like I wasn't going out. So, you know, I don't know. I guess my takeaway on that is that, you know, people are weird, and like that slowly and then all at once feeling, I think that was so true for all of us in our daily lives, like no less true of people in very important professional jobs.
So you were able to get a window into the mind of some of these CEOs. And I was struck in your writing about how, and it obviously is industry dependent, but the nature of what was on their to-do list of their triage was different depending on what it is, right? So Ford is in early March, very worried about supply chain immediately and exposure because of shutdown from China. Delta is very worried about declining is a nice word, plummeting demand, customer demand, as well as labor shortages, right? Can you, I don't know, give us an example that you thought was the most interesting to you about like, how did these CEOs actually say, oh my God, this is what's going on. How do I prioritize the things I have to do? And how do I actually go about knocking them out? And when do I actually need to have that open line of communication with the US government? Because it seemed like regardless of what the individual company, whether it's a blue chip company or bank or whatever it is, had to do, they couldn't do it in a vacuum because the US government response or lack of response, whatever the response was going to be, was going to have such an overwhelming impact on anything that they do.
Ford is, I think, actually a good way to tell that story. And, you know, coming into the pandemic, the first time we meet Jim Hackett and Bill Ford, they're scheming at Bill's ranch in Palm Springs about leadership. This is going to be, they're going to pick a new CEO. And, you know, the idea is 2020 will be kind of an on-ramp for the new guy, Jim Farley, who's now the CEO. They were going to promote him, kind of give him more responsibility. It would be sort of a blue sky day to kind of see what he could do. And, you know, were they ready to hand over the reins? And, you know, within a couple of weeks, right? So they're dealing, I would say, in order with supply chain problems. You know, they end up the kind of thing that companies would do left and right by the end, but they're, you know, chartering these empty 747s and just packing them to the gills with like bolts and rivets and windshield wipers. I mean, all the things that they need that they just cannot get to their factories. And we can talk a little more about that, but obviously that balance between resilience and efficiency, you know, that had been, I think, massively tilted towards the latter over the last, you know, the preceding 10 years or so, got rejiggered in a hurry. You know, very quickly they have what, you know, at its basic is a health problem, but it's really a labor problem, right?
Right.
Not to be unfeeling about it, but this is a book about the economy. It's a labor problem. And there start to be, you know, the first case in Troy was actually not at a Ford plant, but it couldn't matter less because the UAW, right? All of these factories are unionized and they're getting all this pressure from the union to shut the factories down. And actually, you know, in one of those kind of just weird ways that this sort of business world held up what I think were so obviously the right humanitarian things to do. The UAW was trying to get the three CEOs of Ford, GM, and Fiat, Chrysler, on a call that weekend, March 14th, 15th, to talk about this. And they have trouble setting up the call because some of the general counsels of the companies are worried that it's going to be an antitrust violation, that you get three CEOs of these automakers on the line and they're talking about production schedules, right? Very quickly, you end up, if you are perhaps that kind of lawyer, in very complicated collusion grounds. So, you know, that took a couple of extra days. They asked for 48 hours. They came back and ultimately they ended up closing the factories. But I will note that before they did it, Jim Hackett called Larry Kudlow, who was President Trump's top economic advisor, and said, I just want to let you know, we're going to have to shut down the factories. And Larry gives like a deep sigh and says, I'm sure it's the right thing to do, but man, the stock market is just the whole re-election campaign and I'm worried. And actually says something I think actually pretty prophetic that we've been grappling with sort of economically and politically. He says, I'm just worried that if people stop working, you won't be able to get them back. Which to Larry's credit actually foresaw a problem that I'm not sure any of us did at the time when layoffs were the big problem. You know, the idea that you would have trouble getting enough workers seemed insane in those early days. So yeah, so I mean, that I think that Ford story is really interesting. Actually, I'll tell one other Ford story when you're talking about the relationship between corporates and government. One of the things that the government did on the market side very early, it stood up a bunch of these facilities. One was backing money market funds, one was backing commercial paper, one was backing other forms of kind of short-term funding in the market that were collapsing. And eventually they started buying corporate bonds, which is a real departure from anything the government has ever done. They don't like picking winners and losers, right? They don't want to be in the business of really being in the capital structure of companies in the private sector. But they do, they put up the facility, we'll buy a bunch of bonds just to keep a floor under the price of these things so that companies can issue if they need to again. But you had to be investment grade to be eligible for that facility. And Ford had gotten downgraded somewhere between February and the end of March. They'd lost their investment grade rating. There was concern they cut their dividend. I mean, there was real financial pressure. They carried a ton of debt. And Jim Hackett called Larry Fink, CEO of BlackRock, who was administering that program for the government. They were actually buying the bonds and managing those assets. And Ford sort of very delicately says, listen, Larry, like, I don't want to put you in a weird spot, which is funny because Larry had been in a weird spot this whole time. It's a very strange thing to be working for the government on behalf of, you know, buying private company assets. But he said, listen, we're the kind of company that they're trying to save here. This is a technical thing. We got downgraded. We're not in charge of what Moody's does, but we are acting responsibly. We're going to be fine. And that message makes its way all the way up to Steven Mnuchin. And in April, there's a very small change made to that program, which is that if you were investment grade, you know, in early March, and for some reason now you weren't, you were grandfathered in. And honestly, that saved Ford. They did this massive high yield bond offering on the back of it. And that really got them through. So, you know, there were, I think, sort of by hook or crook, I think Jim Hackett was right. Ford was a company worth saving. It was sort of a technical downgrade. But, you know, really, I think pulled all the levers at their disposal to make sure that company was still here on the back end.
This may be an impolite question, but you also have a small story later in the book, or it's probably basically in late March in the book, that Ford starts to produce or manufacture respirators, ventilator, face shields, and they have a fun name for it. I think it's like Project Apollo, right? And all these things. Was that because that was the right thing to do? Was that because of some of the issues that you just kind of laid out, which is an attempt to demonstrate how critical industry was for health and pandemic specific issues? I mean, tell us a little bit of that story, because there was a moment, in the end, it was somewhat fleeting, because I think in the end it didn't, and again, easier in retrospect, meaning it wasn't a significant part of the pandemic response story, but there was a moment of how do you try and convert American industry that's here in the United States to actually manufacturing some of the things that are critical or thought to be critical for pandemic response as partially a way to actually give them some business and partially a way to actually like contribute to the response.
Yeah, I think it's both. It is a little idiosyncratic to Ford. I mean, this is a company, I think really uniquely so, that is American to its core, really that, and sounds a little sort of saccharine and silly to say it, but like deeply patriotic DNA. They made bombers in World War II, despite the fact that actually Henry Ford was a pacifist. They made iron lungs for polio patients. I mean, they see it as their sort of birthright and responsibility to step up. you know, as a business reporter, you're always slightly suspicious of those motives. And so take it with a little bit of a grain of salt. But I think it is actually...
I'm curious, in your reporting and your interviews, you could suss out what the real driving thing here was. But the history is interesting for sure. Yeah.
No, I mean, yes, clearly trying to be part of the solution and not part of the problem. And I will say that I think was a broader theme. You know, the only sort of corollary in recent memory is 2008. And the universe there was much tighter on Wall Street. But like, they were all the bad guys. This was their fault, right? And I think here you saw industry, you know, starting with the banks, all the CEOs had this meeting at the White House on March 11th, sort of very Trumpian meeting. And there are many of them in the book where it's sort of this kind of show for the cameras of these great CEOs. And Trump is, you know, just showering them with compliments about the great men of industry and titans of business. And, but, you know, the idea is to say, we're fine. We are here to be part of the solution, not the problem. It was truer in some cases than others, right? The airline CEOs were there on March 4th saying that. And then, you know, we're back within about 3 weeks asking for $50 billion. So things moved quickly. But I do think companies were very eager to show that they were here to help. I think mostly for admirable reasons. Ford, again, is a little bit of a unique case. But, you know, there were these flurry of press releases in the early days. You know, just pick your blue chip company as donating 50,000 masks that turns out companies stockpile these things and, you know, sending them out to local hospitals. And, you know, as a reporter, in a blue sky day, you would see this and just kind of wad it up and throw it in the trash bin. But there was something kind of earnest about it in the early days. And Wall Street Journal wrote stories about that stuff. So I don't know. I don't think it was permanent, but I do think there was sort of a little bit of a resetting of the public's relationship with business. And we can talk a little bit about sort of how that's continued. But, you know, I think the early days, look, the pandemic, there was this huge vacuum of public sector leadership. I don't think that's an overtly partisan statement to make, but the White House did not handle this well. The CDC, I think, did not cover themselves with glory in a bunch of different ways. And so into that breach, most CEOs, most of these guys, and they're mostly guys, are kind of always living this sort of lifetime movie in their heads, where I'm just kind of waiting for the spotlight to fall on them and rise to the occasion. And look, they mostly did, I think. But the consequence of that is, I think it's a pretty direct line to this kind of world we're in now, where these culture wars, these social issues are just like coming squarely for businesses, right? These CEOs kind of became larger than their jobs. And again, I think mostly for admirable reasons, and stepped up when their employees and their communities were looking for some guidance and some leadership. But I think in some ways really regret it now, because I mean, the job is just really different than it was 3 years ago.
I'm curious, and last question on just how these individual companies kind of reacted, and then we'll move a little bit to the sort of the US government and the ramifications to this day. I think the only tech, and you could debate whether it's tech company, that you really spend a lot of time on in the book is Airbnb, which makes a lot of sense, obviously, given the nature of its business and what it's exposed to and how it'd be impacted by it. Two-part question. One is, why is that in your mind? I mean, I imagine if somebody wrote a book entirely on how tech CEOs reacted to this, it could be a totally different sort of book in that way. So I'm curious in your mind why you made that separation. And then second is, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about Airbnb, because Airbnb is a fascinating story where you would actually figure it would have been the death of the company, at least early on. And I'd have to actually look up today what things look like. But of all of these, it may have been actually the one that is the most successful, and the one that, looking back on the just in 3 years, has actually emerged very, a lot stronger. And so I'd love for you to tell a little bit about why you think that is.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you're right. They are probably, they're certainly as close to tech as you get in the book. You can argue whether they're truly a tech company or not. I mean, I was setting out to kind of, you know, cast my characters, if you will, right? You know, it's a little bit of, who do I know? Where am I positioned? What stories do I genuinely think are interesting? But then you're trying to kind of make sure that you're solving for, is this an actual kaleidoscopic view of the, are you checking most of the sector boxes, right? You need an airline, you need some kind of hospitality company, you need some kind of financial services company, right? You're kind of going, I wanted a manufacturer. So you're kind of going down the list. And I think I chose Airbnb not so much because it's a tech company, because in fact, I don't think Silicon Valley had a uniquely interesting pandemic in any way. Like Amazon obviously became very interesting, but actually not for the tech part of their business, right? It was for really the logistics heavy, the sort of last mile part of their business. I don't think you could say that Apple or Google had a particularly interesting 2 years in any way. You know, despite being the reason that so much of like daily life continued to function, I'm not sure that tech came out of this like weaker or stronger in particular. But I did want different kinds of CEOs. And I wanted, you know, I think Brian Chesky is an interesting kind of counterpoint to Chris Nassetta at Hilton. Same industry, trying to disrupt it, first-time CEO, has sort of none of the institutional muscle memory that Chris has from, you know, the early 90s, from 99, from 08, and, you know, at a very different stage of the corporate life, right? They came into 2020 thinking they were going to go public. And Brian spends the holidays of 2019 with a big stack of prospectuses, kind of circling things he likes, things he doesn't like. How do you tell the story? This is going to be, you know, one of the biggest unicorns to list in a long while. And he decides that the theme is connection. 2020 is going to be a year of connection, and Airbnb is going to be the place that that happens. And setting aside that sort of corporate IPO stories are always a little silly, that just stayed with me like the entire time. Just what one of the sort of business models that just immediately seemed foolish, right? And to your point, you know, they raised a bunch of money in April. And I remember at the time, they raised about $2 billion from some investment firms. And I was a skeptic at the time. I was like you, right? Like, who is going to leave their house, go to a stranger's house? I mean, it just sounded insane at a time when most of us were not going down the block. And I was wrong. And Silver Lake, one of the investors, Sixth Street, these guys were right. And they made a ton of money. And what's interesting to me about that is, you know, for most of the 2010s, there wasn't a lot of value in being contrarian. If you were an investor or a capital allocator, kind of didn't matter what you did. The market went up, right? And two consequences of that. One is that every CEO looks like a genius, whether they are or not. But also that there isn't a lot of value in having a different opinion on a particular market than anybody else, right? You know, it was the most hated equity rally in history because everyone was saying, this makes no sense. Stocks can't keep going up. And they did. And Airbnb to me was sort of the return of this world that we're now living in. If you can just pinpoint a place that it started where smart people had different ideas about how this was going to turn out and laid their bets appropriately. And Alan Waxman, who's the CEO of Sixth Street, did that deal, gets a call from a bigwig in Silicon Valley. It's just like, what the fuck are you thinking? Like, what, are you nuts? And he says, listen, like the way they've structured the deal, as long as Airbnb has like $2 billion worth of value, we're going to be fine. And he says, if Airbnb isn't worth $2 billion, we all have bigger problems, which is to say we are in a Great Depression and the economy has totally collapsed. So, you know, I think that was just a gutsy move. And like, you didn't see a lot of those for a long time. And we're starting to live in a world now where really smart people disagree about the direction of the economy.
I'm surprised. I want to challenge you on something you said in that answer. When you said that you think that on the tech side of things, that you think that it's not that interesting a story or didn't really kind of make a difference, because it leads to my one of my next questions, which is, you know, when you defined earlier the definition of a black swan, right, in the system, which is rare, extreme, and then post facto gets rationalized. And so sometimes a lot of these changes that businesses made in reaction to COVID are essentially bringing to the surface or accelerating changes that they probably wanted to make anyway, couldn't figure out the right way to do it, or this just forced it along in a certain different way. And you see that in a bunch of how they use or ought to use technology in their system, buyouts and layoffs that probably could have occurred earlier in different ways, and so on and so forth. And so I'm surprised by how you say that, because in my mind, there are so many things, everything from day-to-day life of contactless payments and what we're doing right now on Zoom and the way businesses have changed doing business as a consequence, that I would have thought actually are just fast forwarding in a very short amount of time, something that would have happened in a 10 or 20 year period. Do you disagree with that statement?
I'd make two points. One is, take as sort of a proxy for that. It's not a perfect one because it's not an enterprise thing. It's more of a retail thing, but just look at the percent of retail that is brick and mortar or that is e-commerce, right? That share. And, you know, for years, it's kind of going up steadily. Nothing, no hockey stick on that thing. And, you know, during the pandemic, the share of e-commerce massively spikes. And then you know what? It comes back down. And if you continued that trend line from 2015, 16, 17, 18, 19, we're about where you'd expect to be in 2023, which is to say, I think some of that stuff was pulled forward, but not dramatically
pulled up.
Exactly right. Yeah. I think that's a little less true. So things like contactless payments, that clearly has been, you know, that technology has been around for a long time. The US was a much slower adapter than other countries. And that was kind of waiting for a spark to actually kick it into high gear. I haven't looked at the latest numbers, but I suspect that was probably a net win there. But I think some of that stuff was just pulled forward and actually like old habits have kind of returned, to tell you the truth. The other thing, just from a, I think you're embedded in that question, was why didn't I find big tech that interesting? And one is that I've just never covered them, right? I think you'd tell the story that you're best equipped to tell. But to your point, even if there was kind of a big corporate story to tell about, you know, Zoom making all the meetings work, wasn't obvious to me that would be a narratively compelling story, right? It's like, oh, they got a lot more servers and they hooked up the wires and, you know, they changed the time of the meeting from 40 minutes to an hour and everyone loved it. You know, it was such a part of our daily lives of the pandemic. And I tried to kind of sneak that in the narrative. You know, I allowed myself like one you're on mute joke. I can't remember where I used it, but, you know, to kind of show how it had changed the rhythms of doing business. But ultimately, I just didn't think it was that interesting a story. And it wasn't clear to me how lasting those changes were going to be. And I think ultimately less than people think.
I think all the companies that you track, and again, as we were chatting before we started, the manuscript for the book was actually finished. This is the way the publishing industry goes a while ago now, and only came out a couple months ago. And so you're defending something that you last actually touched quite some time ago, and it's hard. But I think it's still true that all the companies that you follow in the book are still in business and seem to have recovered somewhat okay. Did you in your reporting find any example where the miscalculation was so grave that at the end of the day, this was the end of that business? I mean, it would have been fascinating to tell what at the end of the day would have been an absolute failure story in contrast to all the things that you report.
Yeah. And look, you never really know. It's possible. And one thing that I just tried sort of logistically to guard against was kind of self-selection, right? But, you know, the people that I spoke to for the book, and there were a lot of them, started talking to me at a time when that outcome was not at all obvious. You know, I think in my earliest discussions with some of these CEOs, like you could hear, they were genuinely worried they wouldn't make it. And to go back to something we said earlier, the upshot is the federal government saved everyone, right? Like, I think there's a kind of an intellectual thought experiment you can do where you have a pandemic that is half as bad and requires a government response that's half as robust. And you might actually have seen more disparate outcomes, right? The tide, to use whatever Warren Buffett's favorite phrase is, the tide goes like halfway out, right? So some people were exposed to have been swimming naked, some people not so much. I think the upshot here is that gusher of money just kind of papered over, mixing my metaphors here, but filled a lot of cracks in a lot of both business plans and balance sheets. You know, there were stories that I pursued that I ultimately didn't include. One of them was Macy's, which I had really genuinely thought, and to be clear, management was worried too. They were throwing around words like bankruptcy and restructuring. You know, a bunch of reasons to make the final book, but I think there are some companies that, and really some industries where we're just maybe starting to see it. I think it'll be clear in a couple of years where if this was a pivot point, and if you didn't, for example, like really make that pivot to e-commerce, there is a widening gap between you and your competitors. I don't know. I think it's still a little early to tell that. But no, to go back to the story about the subtitle, just a lot less, I mean, genuinely a lot less pain than people thought. I think corporate restructurings actually hit like a multi-year low in 2020 and 2021. They are obviously picking back up now as that era of kind of cheap debt and growing earnings is coming to an end.
I generally don't like asking people counterfactual questions because they're just grossly unfair. But since you opened the door just a little bit, I will do so. You've been a reporter for a long time, and as you said, covered a lot of these companies way before COVID and know a lot of the players here. And in the book, you talk about obviously that one of the things that shocked people so much is that the U.S. economy up until that point had been, I think, in its longest expansion, I think 10 years in its history. Unemployment was at a 50-year low. The labor force participation rate, I think, was at a 15-year high. I mean, really just across the board, great. But at the same time, COVID revealed, it didn't just create, but it also revealed a lot of underlying issues in the American economy that we're living with to this day. And so if you could put your counterfactual hat on, if there was no COVID, do you think that the issues that we are seeing today when it comes to labor questions, when it comes to supply chain questions, when it comes to overexposure, when it comes to efficiency versus resiliency, or, you know, vice versa, do you think that those would never have been surfaced? Or do you think that they would have actually come abreast in 2020 or 2021? Do you think that they would have just been kicked off into the future and we'd really be living in a different reality? And again, I grant the counterfactual is really unfair, but you opened the door just enough for me to be able to ask.
This is on me. This is on me. I guess it probably, I don't know. I mean, I think some of these supply chain stuff would have become less dramatically obvious, but I think, and it's hard to know exactly where sort of the geopolitical landscape would be without COVID, but directionally, I think it would be where it is now. Clearly, COVID unraveled a lot of that kind of, I was talking about that sort of 20, 30 year kind of globalist, small g globalist sort of view and backdrop. But, you know, Brexit was predated the pandemic. That was 2016. The election of Donald Trump had a lot of economic nationalism to it as well. So I think that kind of that retrenching, that anti-globalization, decoupling, whatever you want to call it, would probably have continued anyway. And so we would be grappling not as sharply, not as panicked, but with the same kind of supply chain issues. And I think you would still see the kind of onshoring, reshoring, friendshoring, supply chain diversification that you're seeing now. The real counterfactual that is probably worth getting into is on the monetary policy side. You know, the Fed, central banks around the world have been trying to wean their economies off of free money for years. You know, you'll remember the sort of taper tantrums of the mid-2010s. Yeah. Every time the Fed would try to raise rates, the market would freak out. And they just didn't have either the political or the sort of academic backbone to stick with it. And they always kind of caved and said, okay, no, just kidding. Money's still free. That era would have ended no matter what. Just wasn't necessary for a long time. But the pandemic did two things, right? It extended it by another year or two, probably too long, and then made the recent raise just more dramatic and painful than it probably otherwise, you know, in a blue sky day would have been. Again, I don't like to Monday morning quarterback because these people are smart and they're doing the best they can. But clearly the spigot was open too wide for too long in two ways, right? That last round of stimulus checks, pretty clearly unnecessary and really fueled this consumptive fire that we've seen. And then the Fed was too slow to start raising interest rates, not by a lot, but by a couple of months. They started in spring of 22, almost certainly should have raised that last meeting in 21. And so you get this real steepening interest rate environment, which is, you know, very clearly the spark that ignited the regional bank crisis recently. You know, you have this wall of corporate debt, a lot of real estate debt that is going to mature in the next couple of years at interest rates that are going to double, triple, quadruple. So I think that would have ended anyway. I think COVID has made that more violent.
Yeah. I want to end by asking you one or two questions on geopolitics, because you kind of brought it up. So we started the talk here by you expressing shock in your reporting, but also talking to people about how unprepared or not understanding of what was headed their way given COVID. And that was surprising given how much time, effort, and resources is dedicated to trying to predict the future for given for a lot of these companies. Some of the geopolitical takeaways that most of Washington has certainly taken is about exposure to China, is about global supply chains, is in particularly with potential adversarial nations, is about making sure things are resilient due to shocks in that way, and making sure that there isn't other countries don't necessarily have points of leverage over the United States that could be exploited, let's say, in a crisis. What's your sense of the CEOs of these companies? Do you think that they see the same thing as US political leadership sees on those fronts, and that they are trying to swim in that same direction? Do they look at a potential larger clash between the United States and China and discount it and say that's never going to happen, and therefore we don't really think our business is going to be impacted by that? Do they see the Russian invasion of Ukraine and say, oh, wow, the ramifications of that have been pretty strong. I can only imagine what a potential Chinese attack on Taiwan might look like. Or is it more saying, that's a unique scenario and the impact of that really hasn't been that large and we can kind of discount it? I'm just kind of curious in terms of you having spent so much time talking to and reporting on these CEOs, and your broad takeaway on how they responded to COVID was fumbling around in the dark, whether their reaction to that has been, okay, we need to actually think about these things a little bit differently in the past, or are we back to bumbling in the dark again?
I think some of the, well, so on the China front, no, I think people are taking it very seriously. I can't claim to have talked to every Fortune 500 CEO in the country in the last year, but the ones that I do talk to are disinvesting in China, are shelving whatever China five-year plan they had. You know, I talked to a lot of Wall Street executives, and you know, a lot of them have these JVs in China when the capital markets there started to open in the early part of the last decade. And I think HSBC just the other day said it's buying out its JV partner. I think a lot of them are trying to disentangle themselves from, you know, what has sort of always looked like the next big market and has never really turned into the next big market and is just incredibly, increasingly problematic. So on China front, I do not think they're dismissing it. I think they're very, very serious about it. And I think you'll see a lot of disinvestment there. The real question, I think, and it's for smarter people than me, but is that sort of long-term counterproductive, which is to say, like, there are people who think that you're going to end up with effectively two global financial systems, one built around the dollar and the US economy, and one built around the yuan and the Chinese economy. And I don't know. But if that does happen, I would say that the players that gravitate towards the latter are going to be like a self-selection of really problematic countries and governments. So that, I think, long-term could be really dangerous. You know, that sort of classic trade-off between efficiency, that sort of just-in-time delivery, that this idea, and it's really rooted in technology, I think. You know, this idea over the last 20 years that technology was going to squeeze every bit of friction out of the system. It was going to be disinflationary. It was going to be great for consumers. It was going to, right? And I think that trade-off is being reevaluated. The problem is that if you talk to a CEO, they say, of course, I would like to have a little more fat baked in. Of course, I would like to be a little more resilient, but my investors are going to kill me for it. Like that, I had wondered,
right.
I had it.
What cost, right?
At what cost, right? Like, and you've seen, you know, for example, like activist investors, like arrived in big tech now because their stocks are no longer sort of irrationally high. They're no longer untouchable. It turns out they're massively sort of fat, right? Their expense budgets, these things are insane. And so, you know, I think that disciplining force came back immediately. So then the question you say is, okay, if the market isn't going to allow something that we have just seen in real time is super important, how does the government do that, right? Like, I remember I'd had an early conversation with CEO of one of the big exchanges. And I asked her, I said, like, could we see on the back of this, like an index, like the whatever, the NASDAQ or NYSE Defensive 50? And these are 50 companies who have made a choice to be a little less, take a little less margin, a little less profit, to sort of build in a little friction and a little wiggle room in their supply chain. And investors know that and they like it. It ticks this pandemic box in their portfolio. And it was a nice idea. And absolutely, it never happened, right? We are right back where we started. So then you say, all right, like maybe the government needs to step in. And if we really want to, you know, push companies to keep more inventory here or, you know, do more of their production domestically, then we're probably going to have to incentivize them to do that, which is, you know, where a lot of that chips money comes in. So I don't know, but I think the market does not, whatever lessons we kind of intuitively learn from a management perspective, a lived experience perspective, do not seem to have been internalized by the market, unfortunately.
Yes, well, that's it's a longer discussion, but that's part of the moral hazard, obviously, of government intervention, which is the boards and shareholders are not necessarily going to say, well, you got to have that rainy day fund, you got to have that extra silo, that extra granary, that extra armory, with, you know, whatever it is. Why? Because at the end of the day, somebody else will save your bacon. So that's the way it goes. But Liz, thank you very much for joining us. Wonderful book. Congratulations. Crash Landing, the inside story of how the world's biggest companies survived an economy on the brink. I don't want to say it was a fun book because it's dealing with really serious topics, but I really enjoyed reading. It was fun to read. And despite what you said about tech, you can go buy it on Amazon. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Gabe.
Thank you for listening to the Hamiltonian Podcast. If you enjoyed, please give us a 5-star rating. New episodes are released every other Tuesday, available on every major podcasting platform. To make sure you get notified whenever a new episode is released, be sure to subscribe or visit our website, www.alexanderhamiltonsociety.org.